come back to Shattering This, we're going to turn the page and go back to the text that was initially authored by the individual who predicted that Damascus would fall en route to the destruction of much of the world. That individual, his name is Yahweh. He just so happens to be the creator of the universe, the author of life. And this is what he revealed to us in writing through his Torah, which means teaching. This is Bereshit, Genesis 15:5. We are returning to the passage we were analyzing during our last program. It reads, "And he took him with him to a place which is set apart. And he said, please look at and observe the heavens, the spiritual realm and the universe, and accurately relate. Make a written record of the light of the stars and the power, if you are able to comprehend and understand, to recount, to record, and to reveal the relationship in writing. And he promised him in this manner, here and now, and then, this exists as your offspring." What we considered in yesterday's program is that God led Abraham to a place that's set apart, that he's offering that same guidance to all of us. If you want to live with him, he is offering to take you to this place that is set apart. It is presented symbolically as Israel. It is presented symbolically as the promised land. It is also, he took him to a place where he could observe the heavens. Heaven is his home. So he took him to this place. And he took him with him. God's idea of our voyage of discovery, and this was a voyage of discovery for Abraham, is that we do it together. God took him with him. We go and we also are being invited to explore the universe with its creator. That's exactly what Yahweh was doing with Abraham. It is what he is offering for all of his covenant children. And it's the entire universe. You know, Yahweh did not take Abraham to a two blocks away. You know, he didn't take him from the high ground of around Jerusalem down to the Dead Seas and knock on the doors of Sodom and Gomorrah. He took him to this place which was set apart so that he could observe the spiritual realm, the heavens. He took him where we're going to go, to explore his universe so that he might understand the magnitude of the universe. And particularly, he took him to the spiritual realm, the Shamayim, the place where we will endure spiritually, because the covenant inheritance is a spiritual inheritance. That's where God took him. That's where he is offering to take us. And then he said, what I want you to do while you're here is I want you to accurately relate to. After you've observed, I want you to consider. And then I want you to communicate. Make a written record of the light of these stars, the power that you're witnessing here in the spiritual realm. And there's a reason for that. You see, God explains that he is light. He says that he created us in his image. He tells us that he's going to empower us. The way that you empower a material being is you free them from the confines of matter so that they experience the multiplicity power, a multiplicative power of the speed of light times the speed of light. E equals MC squared. That's the multiplication that he was showing to Abraham. That's what he's revealing to us. We're currently a material being. Here's Abraham. He was all frustrated that, you know, here down on earth, he doesn't have a kid. And Yahweh took him to experience the power of light, of energy, of the spiritual realm, and said, this is what I want you to relate to. And as Einstein proved through his equation, that when you transition from matter to light energy, while they are the same thing, they aren't the same amount of the same thing. You get to be multiplied by the speed of light times the speed of light. Enormous factors involved here. The square of the speed of light. He's essentially giving us Einstein's equation. Come to understand this, relate to this, observe this, pay attention to this, comprehend this, and then you'll understand the inheritance that I'm offering you. I'm going to make you like the stars. I'm going to empower you as if you were light. Now, what happens if you're light? Well, first of all, we've just talked about this transition from being a material construct to being an energy-based construct is so multiplicitous, you have to multiply 186,000 miles a second times itself. This is the impact of this empowerment that he's talking about. That's why God says, I'm going to empower you. But beyond that, light is eternal. Light energy cannot be destroyed. And the most amazing thing is what Einstein also had to tell us about light. About time being relative. That on a photon of light, time simply exists. That's why the closing rate when a photon of light is, and a wave of light is coming towards one another. So two photons, two waves of light coming together directly. The closing speed is the speed of light, not twice the speed of light. And the reason for that is that on each of those photons of light, time simply is. You know, you can't equate to speed when there is no measure of time. Speed is always distance over time. But when time simply is, all the distance in the universe can be transitioned in no time at all. That's why, as a spiritual being, which is what Yahweh was promising us, not physical bodily resurrection, which would be a horrible handicap, but as a spiritual being, how we will be able to do this very thing with him, go with him and explore the universe, because we will be able to travel to any place we wish to see instantly. No time at all. And we become instantly eternal because light cannot be destroyed. And because with light, time simply exists. And it's interesting here, of course, that the language that Yahweh chose to reveal himself to us, he told us twice that the word of Yahweh appeared to Abraham. The words that Yahweh revealed were in Hebrew. Hebrew is the only language where the verbs simply are. They're just like light. There's no past, present, or future tense in Hebrew. Time is. All Hebrew verbs are flow throughout the whole course of time, past, present, and future, incorporating all of time in the action of the verb, just as is the nature of light. That's something Yah revealed to us at the very beginning of his Torah. He equated himself to light, and he said that he spoke the universe into existence using words. These are very powerful concepts. And here, even as Yahweh is encouraging Abraham, after he's taken Abraham to this place that signifies the nature of the inheritance that this covenant relationship is providing not only him, but all of us who choose to participate in it. After taking him to this place, encouraging him to observe what he is witnessing, and then to relate to it, to kafar, the word that he used to relate to it, speaks of communicating words in writing. Make a written record. And a written record of what? Of all of this power. Of the very substance of these stars. And he says, if you're able to comprehend and understand, which that's the goal. Because Abraham made a statement. His statement was posed as a question. It really is even a complaint. You know, why are you talking to me about this marvelous inheritance that's going to empower me, it's going to enrich me, and specifically empower and enrich my heirs, and I don't even have a kid? I've got no family. I've got this servant from Damascus, and he's going to inherit all that I have. And God says, no, I'm not going to be him. We're not going to Damascus here. It's going to be your heir from your genitalia, because we're going to do this the right way. It's going to be the product of you and your wife coming together in love, in the marriage, in your home, to conceive this child. And then we're going to name this child in such a way that it defines the entire purpose of the covenant. We're going to name him Ishak, which means laughter. So you know what? He's laying it all out for us. He's telling us what the covenant is all about, what the inheritance of the covenant is going to be, how we can relate to it, how we use his words in conjunction with the nature of light energy to accurately observe and relate to what God is offering for us. And it's exactly as it needs to be. So long as we are material, we are subject to the second law of thermodynamics. Things go from order to disorder. Life is fragile. We are mortal. The older we get, the more decrepit we become. We do not want to be tied to these material bodies, because as a material being, we will never go beyond the moon. We are tethered right here. We can't go any further. You can't speed to the point where you can even get to the next planet in our solar system, much less to the next solar system. It's a horrible liability. And so God is telling us, you want to know what I'm offering you? You want to understand what I'm offering you? Comprehend this, as he took him into the heavens to witness a universe of stars. Then he says, I want you beyond coming to comprehend and understand this, recognizing this information. I want you to recount, record, and reveal this relationship in writing. The basis of the Torah. It's the purpose of the Torah. It's why the scroll of the Torah is kafar, in writing, just as this instruction to Abraham and through him to us encourages. And Yahweh promised him, in this manner, here and now, this exists as your offspring. Now, what kafar? Maybe the most telling term in this passage. And in fact, that's what the word means, to tell. It is somewhat difficult for most people to understand, because English Bibles are wont to translate this, I want you to count the stars, and they go back to the mundane. Now, here's Abram. He's confused because his mind is in the mundane. He's saying, God, I don't understand why you're promising to empower and to enrich my me through an inheritance when I don't even have a kid. See, he's in the mundane, and Yahweh lifts him up to the profound. He takes him from the material world to the world of light and energy. Takes him from earth to heaven. And yet, they want to stay bound to the earth, and they said, count the stars. Well, of the 161 times that kafar is found in the Torah, it is scribed, scribe or write, 54 times. Tell or recount, 44 times. Relate and declare, 34 times. And that's because kafar is a written document. You know, Yahweh constantly refers to his Torah as kafar, the written scroll of the Torah. And just one time to say, you know, I want to change the word from scribe and write, change it from tell and recount, change it from relate and declare to count, makes God a liar. And, you know, if you look up in the sky, there's that band of stars that we call the Milky Way, because it's a sideways look into the Milky Way galaxy, which we're part of. That's why it's the brightest band of stars. It's the arm of the Milky Way galaxy that we happen to be in. That's not the whole Milky Way galaxy. It's just the arm of the Milky Way that we happen to be in. You know how many stars there are just in our galaxy, the Milky Way? 400 billion. Do you know that there's over 100 billion galaxies? So there's 100 billion galaxies. Our own galaxy has 400 billion stars. Maybe the average is 100 billion stars. In total, somewhere between 10 and 15 billion people have lived on this planet. Probably since the time of Abraham, the number is probably around 10 to 12 billion people that have lived on this planet. If everyone on this planet was Abraham's descendant, which they obviously are not, it would be nowhere close to the 400 billion stars just in this one galaxy, much less all of the galaxies of the universe, which is more than 100 billion times 100 billion. So why do, you know, there's a challenge when you translate. And I'm not going to claim to be the world's greatest translator. I may be the translator that is most desirous of making the translations as accurate as possible and as consistent with Yahweh's testimony as possible, but I certainly would not place myself as a world-class translator. But how in the world would you, as a translator, twist a word and render it as an obscure portion of what the word could potentially mean as count, then just render the next word as stars without thinking of the etymology, history of that word and its power and the nature of light, and to have God's statement be obviously untrue, and jump right back into the mundane and says, your offspring is going to be more numerous than the stars that you can count, because that's just not true. And it doesn't take us anywhere. What good, I mean, if you want to think about what God is offering Abram, what good would it be for him to know that his descendants would be more numerous than the stars that you can count? How would that be of any value to him? Why would he want to leave Ur in Babylon and come to this place that at the time was Canaan, this little strip of land along the Mediterranean Sea? Why take all of that walk, go from an incredibly sophisticated place to this backwater place, just so that you're going to have a lot of descendants? And you're 100 years old, nearly 100 years old. Even having one is not necessarily going to do you a whole lot of good. But as many as the stars, it's meaningless to Abraham. It's not a benefit. Now, being empowered like light, becoming immortal like light, being able to travel the far reaches of the universe with Yahweh, as this depicts, understanding the universe, now that's an offer worth considering. Seeing the etymology, which is the history, the study of the word kafar, as it's used in this statement, which is to relate, it is to declare, it is to scribe, it is to write, it is to tell, it is to recount that which you're being shown, so that other people can benefit from it, so that they can, that we in turn can observe through Abram's eyes and experience what he observed, where Yahweh took him. And you cause you to just sit there and wonder and say, why then, as profound as that is, did religious publications universally dumb it down to say, count the stars? Why would they do that? And once you realize that they have hoodwinked everyone into thinking that God lied to Abram, as opposed to answering a mundane statement with a profound response, why would they still trust those religious institutions? So it's an interesting question, and it's a question that should prompt some research to find out how many other times have these religious publications deliberately misled others. And, you know, Shane and I, during the commercial break, were talking about just the Torah in itself. You know, what is the Torah? How does it relate to the Jewish religion? And,
I've got a question for you here.
Yeah, sure.
Just doing a little research for myself on the Torah, and I'm new to the show, so a lot of this is new to me. So I'm just kind of, you know, was going out and doing my own research on the Internet as we're doing the show here. How does the Kabbalah relate to the Torah? And, you know, I was doing this research and kind of just came across as a side note, Kabbalism and Jewish mysticism. How does that relate, and what's your take on that?
Okay, first of all, my take on you being curious, because here we're talking about the Torah and doing some research as to what do others say about the Torah, that is the single best response a person can have. I mean, you ought to care enough about this material to say, well, is there substance here? You know, is there really merit in this? And what do other people have to say about this book? That is always the best course of action. Now, there's a real challenge when you look up the word Torah in the Internet or any place else. And that is that the Torah has been described, has been categorized as a religious book that belongs to the Jews, that is comprised of a set of laws, that it's part of the Jewish religion. And therefore, Kabbalah, which is the mysticism of Rabbinic Judaism, is associated with it. And I'm going to get to Kabbalah in a moment, but I'd like to lay a little foundation before we get there, if that's all right with you, Shane.
Yeah, absolutely.
According to Yahweh, the Torah is his. It's not a Jewish book. According to Yahweh, he hates religion, despises it. In fact, one of the most frequent themes throughout the Torah is criticism of Jews for being religious. So there is nothing religious at all associated with Yahweh's Torah, nor is it a Jewish book. It belongs to Yahweh.
Okay.
He claims it to be his. Next thing that's interesting is that the word Torah in Hebrew does not mean law. Means teaching. There is an enormous difference between law and teaching. Laws restrict. Teaching liberates. The more you learn, the more empowered you are. But with laws, the more laws there are, the more your freedoms are restricted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They are really opposites. You know, there is. It's interesting that there is no Hebrew word for obey. None. So God never once say, I want you to obey my laws. Never.
See, that's interesting to me, coming from a background growing up in a Christian family, because you're taught, it's pounded into your head from day one, this obey, follow God's commandments, you know, that sort of thing. So that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, you know that what's called the commandments, that there isn't a command in the group of them?
No, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's called they're called the Ten Commandments. There isn't a command in the ten of them. The imperative mood is only used in one of the ten statements. Yahweh, by the way, calls them the ten statements. And there's two tablets. The first three are comprised of sweeping overall statements about the relationship between God and humanity, and literally based upon the nature of the covenant. And then the following seven are written on the second of the two tablets, 77 Hebrew words on each of them. And the second tablet then has seven specific instructions as to how we can relate to one another and to God. There's only one of the seven that was written in the imperative mood. But before we go to the imperative mood, which is the only mood in Hebrew which can be used to issue a command, the imperative mood, 95% of the time that it's used, is the voice of volition. What it expresses is first person desire. It's so the speaker in the imperative mood is saying, this is what I would most like. This is what I would, this is my desire. If you want to know my will, this is my desire. but it's not being issued as a command. 95% of the time the imperative mood is used, it communicates a desire. So you now have these seven instructions on the second of those two tablets. One of the seven is written in the imperative mood, and it's the one which compulsion is the most impossible. Just to emphasize the point, that's what God typically does. It happens to be the one that says, view your mother and father as very significant. Now, God is not telling it just rendered honor thy father and mother, so it's that's not what the word kabod means. It means to value, to view as very significant. And the second of the three statements, Yah says that fathers mislead to their children. They corrupt them, leading to them to their own demise, to the third and fourth generation. So Yah is not telling you to value what your father is telling you, not your earthly father. My earthly father was anti-Semitic. He was so mean to my brother, to my mother, and to myself, I had to get a restraining order against him. You know, it would not do me much good to highly esteem my earthly father. The father and mother that Yahweh, through the imperative mood, is telling us that it's his hope that we value is our heavenly father and spiritual mother. The spiritual mother is the set-apart spirit. Our heavenly father is the father of the covenant. And so that's the only one the imperative mood is used, and this is a choice for us. So there are no commandments, which is interesting. And God doesn't have any laws. The Torah is comprised of instructions. There's a huge difference between instruction and law. The reason that growing up in a Christian family would be drilled into you that the Torah is filled of laws is that was Paul's take on it.
Right.
But Paul was a false prophet. Paul negated the Torah, said the Torah was enslaved, that it was incapable of saving anyone. And Yahweh says exactly the opposite. He says the Torah is for flawed people. It's the only people there are. And so I've given you my Torah to liberate you, to free you.
Right.
And that's what guidance and teaching does. All right, so understanding that, the next part of it would be this connection between Torah and Judaism. There's this myth that Jews are Torah observant, but they're not. They're Talmud observant. If you approach any religious Jew, particularly a rabbi, they're not going to quote the Torah. They will quote their Talmud. And the Talmud, there's two versions of the Talmud. There's the Jerusalem Talmud, and there's the Babylonian Talmud. The dominant Talmud is the Babylonian Talmud, and written about 500 of the Common Era, about 100 or so years before the creation of Islam. And it is a series of arguments between rabbis. You know, the first rabbi to establish rabbinical Judaism, which is the Judaism that is practiced today, was Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva came up with this plan in around 133 CE of the Common Era, that since there is free will expressed in the Torah, that the God of the Torah is therefore inclined to accept a vote. And if the God and the rabbis differ, then we will count the votes. God gets a vote, the rabbis get their vote. And if the rabbis outvote God, then it's the rabbis' will that will prevail. And then he wrote the rabbinical will in the Talmud. That was his argument. And so religious Jews adhere to the Talmud and to the Mishnah, which is writings by Maimonides, the Ramban, about 1000 CE. They pay very little attention to the Torah. In fact, it was the Ramban that said there are 613 laws that comprise the Torah. That's not true. There are no laws in the Torah, and the number 613 is wholly irrelevant and inaccurate. So that's the next aspect of it. Now, as it relates to Kabbalah, Kabbalah is a derivative of Jewish mysticism. It is something that has its roots also in Maimonides, the Rambam. The Rambam is a Masoretic. He was one of the those that wanted to vocalize the alphabet that comprises the Torah and the prophets, even though it already had five vowels amongst the 22 letters. And he, writing in Moorish Spain, began to expound on what he thought were the principles of Judaism. Then Islam became ruthless in Spain, and Jews were hunted down and killed. So he actually fled to Morocco, and then ultimately would come to write most of what he did while serving the Islamic vizier in Egypt. And he is the fellow that wrote the 13 principles of rabbinic Judaism, all of which contradict Yahweh's own testimony. And he is the first to conceive Kabbalah. Kabbalah is, when you read the Zohar and the books of Kabbalah, what you find is that these rabbis have inverted everything. They've essentially replaced Yahweh with the adversary, Hasatan. And they've created a mysticism based upon a doctrine that is very similar to the Babylonian religion, where almost everything God says is inverted. And every statement that he's made is twisted using numerology and imagery that is wholly satanic. So, great question, Shane, and we can discuss it after the commercial break. Now, welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths. There's very few myths that are more important to shatter than religious myths. It is interesting that Kabbalah has really taken a life of its own. It's now one of the world's fastest growing religions. It is being embraced by many of the elite, particularly those in Hollywood. It was, by the way, a huge influence in Adolf Hitler. And his occultism. As I read the Kohar and the Zohar, and Kabbalah, it just appeared to me that it was an even purer representation of the will of the adversary, Hasatan, than was Islam. As adroit as Islam is to being Satan's ultimate dream, to be worshipped as God. So was the Zohar. So was Kabbalah. And as a matter of fact, what I actually see in the religion is that, like all religions, they take the opposite view. Rather than man being created in the image of God, they create a God in man's image. And so in the Zohar, the two opposing forces, the two distinct gods, good and evil, are warring against each other. And they're equals because man is always warring against one another. Rabbinic Judaism is based upon rabbinic arguments because man is constantly arguing with his fellow man.
And why is it that we put so much of our own image on God instead of realizing that we're in God's image? Why is that?
I think it's because very few people take the time to actually read what Yah's Torah instructions are to us. If you read and consider the Torah, you recognize we have been created in God's image, and that what he has to tell us is profound, that he proves that he authored the book, and he proves that what he is offering us is reliable through prophecy. But rather than deal with that, because our religions tell us, no, we've got a better answer, listen to us instead of to God, most people discount the source where God himself has reached out to us and said, here's reality. And they have created religions in opposition to that reality. And so you grew up in a Christian family. What would you'd expect to hear the opposition to the Torah as opposed to the Torah?
Yeah.
Right?
Another question, too, mm-hmm. And maybe this is, obviously a lot of the listeners have probably moved a long ways beyond the point that I'm at here, but why is it so easy for us to fall into that as humans? Our way to kind of lead us astray like that?
No, that's a profound question. The reason that I think religions become popular is that they dominate society. To be opposed to Christianity, for example, in America, and to speak out against it makes one very unpopular. People tend to go along to get along. And so, if you look at the rise of Christianity as a religion after Constantine, and he made it legal to be a Christian, and then went one step further and called Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, Christianity became popular because to not be a Christian was to be ostracized. And so you live in an Islamic society. If you're not a Muslim, you have no rights. You can't. You're not a citizen. You literally, you can't marry a Muslim woman, which is all the women there. You can't own land. Your property is seized from you. You can't speak out. So, and if you were born a Muslim and you give up Islam in an Islamic country, they kill you. So, you know, it's pretty easy to see why you would continue to be a Muslim. Right. For the 1,000 years that the Roman Catholic Church controlled Europe, if you spoke against the church in any way, they would incarcerate you, they would torture you, and then they would kill you. Most people aren't willing to say, you know, I'm not going to go along.
Right.
I'm going to reject that. Imagine in America with this integration of religion and politics that we have, somebody saying, you know, you ought not be patriotic. You ought not be political. Right. You ought not buy into this because you're being lied to. You know, it's a tough position to take because even though it's true, the vast majority of people are going along to get along. Lies have always been more seductive. Now, particularly, the most direct answer to your question is that people are can't handle death. And so if your parent that you love died, if your child died, if your parents died, people can't process the idea that they'll never see them again. So they create religions for the express purpose of causing them to be comfortable with the notion that they're in a better place, that they're still alive, that they're looking down on them, and that they will be reunited with them again. Of course, it's a lie, but it makes them feel good. We'll be back tomorrow with Shattering This. May God bless.